This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I see the melting horizon, warning in the night. Our planet's pleading, can't you see the light?
So it's sort of like a ticking time bomb, some of the changes going on now. We know we've locked it in, or we're beginning to lock certain things in. And at some stage, they will play out. That can't be changed.
Ice is melting, oceans rising to the sky.
World-changing tipping points in Antarctica. And a deep dive, climate in your brain. Following an emergency summit of polar scientists in Australia, renowned expert Professor Matt King on tipping points in Antarctica and the Southern Ocean, how they could rearrange the world. Then stay tuned as recovering neuroscientist and climate sleuth Clayton Aldrin talks about his new book, The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. Hidden from us all, huge changes are emerging at the bottom of the world, Antarctica. Hundreds of scientists just held an emergency summit in Australia. Just out, this new paper, Cascading Tipping Points of Antarctica and the Southern Ocean. Published December 10th, extinction-level global changes might start there, down under. Professor Matt King is a renowned Australian scientist specializing in polar geodesy and Arctic research. He is currently a professor at the University of Tasmania and director of the Australian Centre for Excellence in Antarctic Science. From Hobart, Tasmania, Matt King, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you, Alex.
Well, for openers, what is geodesy, and what has that got to do with Antarctic research?
It's a great question, and a very common question. So geodesy is the study of the shape of the Earth, its gravity field, and the way it rotates, and how those things change over time. And all of those things change over time as mass is moved around the surface of the Earth. So as Antarctica or Greenland increasingly melt, and that all that weight of water goes into the oceans, that changes the shape of the Earth, it changes Earth's gravity field, it changes Earth's, the way Earth rotates and the axis of rotation and the rate of rotation. And so by studying those things, you can indirectly learn about the changes that are going on the surface of the Earth and also in the interior of the Earth as well. So we use measurements of the changing gravity of the Earth over Antarctica to understand how much ice is being lost into the ocean that's not being replaced by snowfall. That's one example of the use of geodesy in Antarctic science.
So you can do that from space without even having to measure from research stations on the spot?
Yeah, and there's a load of research that we do and can be done from space, from satellites orbiting a few hundred kilometres to, much higher altitudes above the surface of the Earth. You know, some of those measurements are really great for Antarctica. Some of them are more limited because there's a lot of cloud over Antarctica quite often. And so anything that's sort of like, an image-based, camera-based system is a bit more challenging. We use satellite-based measurements for everything from measuring the speed of the glaciers and how they're changing over time to the elevation of the ice, the gravity or the mass change, as I talked about, mapping surface melting on the surface of Antarctica that happens sometimes in the summer. You know, all those sorts of things can be done by space. I'd have to say, though, that getting into the field and making measurements in the field, whether that's from airborne platforms or on the ground, are absolutely critical. They can't be replaced by satellite measurements, but we can do a lot with satellites.
Here on Radio EcoShock, we cover tipping points a lot, including with Tim Lenton. An Australian scientist, Matthew England, suggested a deep Antarctic current might have tipped. But until this new paper, most of us think of Antarctica as a long-term story unwinding over centuries. Why look for tipping points there and in the Southern Ocean?
And that view of a slowly changing, almost frozen Antarctica that maybe changes over thousands of years, that was actually very common view, even in the 1980s, 1990s. And then as we've managed to collect information from the field, from satellite observations, we've seen very dramatic things happen over weeks, days, sometimes hours. And so we now know that Antarctica is not just sitting down in the bottom of the Earth frozen and not doing very much. We know that it's capable of changing very rapidly, and it has started to change rapidly in many areas. And we know that those things don't just stay in Antarctica. They come to us by way of changing sea levels, changing global weather and climate patterns. The work that you talked with Matt England about, that changes the amount of oxygen and nutrients being distributed into the deep ocean all around the world, and that'll have effects on our ability to feed human populations from fisheries. So we know that these things matter for everyone, and we know that things are changing and can change rapidly in Antarctica, so we know that now. And as we've built our knowledge base of Antarctica, we've seen that there are actually potentially tipping points. You know, if we push the glaciers on land, for instance, down in Antarctica, some of those are in a potentially unstable configuration. And by that I mean, if they retreat to a certain point and the bedrock is sort of ever deepening as you go in towards the interior of the ice sheet, so the ice is sitting on this bedrock that's ever deepening as you go into the interior, well, that's an unstable configuration. And if the ice retreats back to that point, it will start to run downhill, so to speak, and in a way that actually fully complies with the definition of a tipping point, and that it's self-reinforcing and it can be quite abrupt. We know that there are tipping points in the system, and we know that there are complicated tipping points in the system. You know, there are cascading tipping points. So the increase in melt that comes from the glaciers interrupts the ocean circulation that you've discussed previously. The melting of sea ice, that's the frozen ocean around Antarctica, well, that has tipping points that cascade into the biological systems. So the emperor penguin, one of the most iconic species on Earth, you know, they breed on the ice in the middle of winter. But if there is no sea ice, this frozen ocean, because the ocean's sufficiently warmed, the emperor penguins enter into their own tipping point, and that could occur by the end of the century. There's a bunch of very complicated tipping points, and they are not unrelated with each other. And so we need to understand what those look like, what rate of change could occur if we do pass them, when might we pass those tipping points, and what action do we need to avoid that, which is obviously the critical thing, because we just don't want to go there. But of course, you know, as with all tipping points, even once you pass a tipping point, every tenth of a degree still matters, because we can continue to push it downstream, so to speak, or we can act to avoid the worst, even with tipping points.
There's been a lot of concern in science and in the public about ocean circulation changing in the North Atlantic at the Gulf Stream or the AMOC, however you want to label it. And that certainly would affect weather in the United Kingdom and in North America and Europe. But here we have ocean currents around Antarctica and the Southern Ocean that we can barely even name. We don't really know what they are in the public. And yet, these are fundamental to the weather systems of the whole world. Would you talk a bit about those circulation systems and why they matter so much?
Antarctica is surrounded by is land with ice on top of it, surrounded by the ocean. It's quite different to the Arctic. In fact, it's the opposite of the Arctic, which is ocean surrounded by land. And there we have the mighty Southern Ocean completely circling Antarctica. And in the Southern Ocean we have the Antarctic Circumpolar Current, which is the world's strongest ocean current that circles around, or literally does circle around Antarctica. It's a very powerful current that actually has been protecting Antarctica from mid-latitude and low-latitude climate warming, because it's very hard to penetrate through that circling of ocean water, and that's an area of ongoing study about how heat does get across that barrier. But we also know that actually some of the densest waters on Earth are formed around the coastline of Antarctica, and they sink down deep into the ocean and they go out and fill global ocean basins. You know, we're talking about 3,000 metres, 4,000 metres deep, you know, filling vast amounts of the ocean. So the things that happen in Antarctica are propagating out all over the world, and of course that water eventually comes back up to the surface, where whatever has been embedded in the water, you know, oxygen and nutrients, and has been transported along, well, those things come up to the surface, and so the changes that are happening now in Antarctica will eventually surface somewhere else in the surface waters of the Earth, and that's where they'll have the effect. So it's sort of like a ticking time bomb, some of the changes going on now. We know we've locked it in, or we're beginning to lock certain things in, and at some stage, they will play out. That can't be changed. So Antarctica does have an outsized role. We know that not even outside the ocean currents, you know, the reflection of the white snow and ice, or relatively white ice, reflecting energy back into space, that keeps the Earth cool, drives seasonal change. You know, there's a whole bunch of other systems that actually govern global climate, and, you know, the way Antarctica is at the moment has helped the planet stay the way it is, or has been until recently. So major change in Antarctica really results in major change for the planet in terms of our weather systems.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock, science-based news about the real world. To discuss more worrying news coming out of Antarctica, our guest is Dr. Matt King, polar expert and research leader. Matt, tell us about the first Australian Antarctic Research Conference held November 2024 in your backyard in Hobart.
Yeah, this was a really exciting meeting because for whatever reason, we've never had a national Antarctic Research Conference, at least not for 10 years. And we had 450 of Australia's leading Antarctic researchers come from all over the country into Hobart, and we met. And, you know, there are a number of things that struck me. First of all, there were a lot of early career researchers. This is an area of research that actually is full of hope because we've got, you know, an increasing number of young people generally who want to join in and help understand Antarctica, understand it, sort of revel in the awe and wonder of it, of the place that it is. It's such a special place, but also advance our knowledge as quickly as we can. And I'd say that we've not been advancing our knowledge as quickly as we need to get ahead of some of the surprises that have come at us. And we also spoke about some of those surprises. We talked about the dramatic changes in the sea ice around Antarctica, that is, you know, the frozen ocean that has dramatically declined in terms of its winter peak and its annual cycle over the last few years. That's not fully understood, but that was discussed. Changes in the ozone hole and the impact on Antarctic vegetation, that was discussed. Future sea level projections, that was discussed. Trying to understand very fine-grained details of how things work in Antarctica. Well, there were dozens of presentations about that, and loads of these had, you know, climate change sitting in the background, if not in the foreground of their presentations. And we also worked together on, you know, there's new marine science voyages that are underway next year, a major Australian Antarctic voyage to the Denman Glacier in Antarctica, which alone has 1.5 meters of sea level capacity. So that one glacier, if it all melted, would raise global sea levels on average by 1.5 meters, barely studied, and there's a voyage going down, and so some of the scientists who are working on that met together to talk and plan and discuss that piece of work. So there were things going on everywhere. But it was a very exciting meeting and really wonderful to have, you know, physical scientists, biological scientists, social scientists all there together talking about Antarctica and sharing knowledge.
Well, just to fill in the players, what is the Australian Antarctic Program Partnership? Who funds that and what does that do?
Yeah, so in Australia there's sort of four major bodies, I guess. So there's the Australian Antarctic Division, which is a government organization. It runs Australia's bases, it runs the ships and the aircraft, it has science and policy people. And then there's the university sector, in which there are actually three large programs. One of them is the Australian Antarctic Program Partnership. It's based here at the University of Tasmania, and it's a partnership with some government agencies, including the Australian Antarctic Division. And it works to try and understand Antarctica's role in the global climate system, and it's sort of, you know, focused very heavily on, you know, physical climate change, physical processes that are occurring in the climate system. And then there are a couple of other large efforts. The one that I lead is the Australian Centre for Excellence in Antarctic Science. It's a collaboration of 7 universities across Australia where we're trying to understand climate risks that are coming from East Antarctica and the Southern Ocean. So we're working on that, and we partner very closely with the AAPP. And then there's another program based at Monash University called Securing Antarctica's Environmental Future. They've got a particular interest in ecosystems, especially on land, change policy, and how that all links with changing climate as well. And so we, you know, all those groups are operating in parallel. We work together, and together we work together to coordinate this conference, this Australian Antarctic Research Conference.
Well, it's powerful science coming out of Australia. Now, you're not alone. China has established 5 research stations in Antarctica, with the latest being that futuristic Qinling station opening in February 2024. There's 70 permanent research stations in Antarctica, 29 countries. Australia's got 4 of them, but Argentina has 13. Japan's there, Pakistan, Bulgaria. Why are so many countries building bases there, and how good is the information sharing between these places?
So the first thing to say is that Antarctica is governed, no one owns Antarctica. Antarctica is governed by the Antarctic Treaty System, which was signed in 1959. And it's a remarkable document because it preserved, so the nations came together, who's the original signatories and more have joined since, and they agreed that Antarctica be preserved for peace and science. And I think that's a wonderful thing to reflect on in a world that is, you know, where we see peace and science being preserved, you know, perhaps less than we would like, much less than we would like. Here we have Antarctica has been set aside for peace and science. And so that governs the use of Antarctica. You know, there are claims on Antarctica. Australia has those. They're effectively they're not thrown out, but they're not endorsed by the Antarctic Treaty. They're effectively frozen, so to speak, in time, and the Antarctic Treaty is in existence and will be out into the future. So nations are able to come to Antarctica for purposes of peace and science. The overwhelming activity in Antarctica from all those stations is scientific knowledge, and so nations want to gather knowledge that might inform on their own climate understanding, and so that's the heart of the reasons. You know, I think it would be foolish to say that there's not a geopolitical thing that's going on there in various places and they're complicated, but the overwhelming purpose of all of those stations, every one of them, regardless of which nation you look at, is all about science and doing science in their area of operations. And the collaboration between nations is excellent. Look, if you go even back to the Cold War, there were scientists exchanging, American scientists exchanging information with Russian scientists on Antarctica. And that tradition has long continued up to the present day, where nations work together because really they have to work together. Antarctica can't be solved by one nation or even a small group of nations. Logistically, you know, things break, things, you know, ships break down, they need to be rescued. That requires cooperation. We need to get people into the field. That requires cooperation on air transport. And so the whole thing only really works with cooperation, and science certainly is a collaborative effort.
Well, there's so much new science coming out. I'm hoping in the new year to spend at least one program investigating the tipping points and the other issues coming from the South Pole. I'm a little concerned about the time lag of getting these new ideas about what's going on there out to the public. It can be really slow to penetrate people's consciousness that, yes, we should be concerned about Antarctica and the Southern Oceans. Do you have ideas on how we can go beyond the science and get this word out?
Oh, look, I completely agree. And even here in Australia, where, you know, the next stop south of us is Antarctica, Antarcticans can feel very far removed from our day-to-day existence. And yet, you know, every day our weather patterns are influenced by what's going on in the Southern Ocean. Every day a little bit of Antarctica arrives on our coastlines in the form of sea level rise. And there's a whole bunch of other things as well. But it is a real challenge, and it means, and actually it's a challenge for scientists to stop just doing science and actually collaborate and work really intimately with non-scientists, especially social scientists, but also people in economics and in other fields as well, because it's the stories of Antarctica that really will resonate and connect with people, you know. And so those people who are, you know, really passionate about Antarctica might fall into those who are, you know, care about the environment and the specialness of that place. That's been communicated through movie and film and novels. There are other people who have been connected in with Antarctica because they recognize actually it's an important part of our economy, actually, and they care about that. You know, there's $200 billion a year of carbon absorbed into the Southern Ocean that would otherwise be in the atmosphere, and the economy would have to lift up to that extent to cover that carbon. So that there's stories to be told, but we're not doing that really well at the moment. And I was even just reflecting, and maybe some of your listeners are interested in this. There's not even really a great sort of popular science book about Antarctica, as far as I know. For modern day science, you know, there's all the heroic era stuff of, you know, Scott of the Antarctic and Shackleton, Sir Douglas Mawson. Something that tells the current day science in a popular and accessible way, that's lacking. So we need to work harder on this, and it's not just the scientists who are going to solve that problem.
Calling all artists, have a look at Antarctica and see how you can help out. As we wrap up here, I just want to ask, I mean, I'm intrigued that the Earth can be deformed and that possibly even time itself can be just slightly altered by that. What kind of projects do geodesic specialists take up, and what are some of the high points learned?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, we've known for more than a century that Earth changes shape. As the great ice sheets have melted, the Earth has rebounded in that area and they subside in other areas. And that's really about processes that are occurring deep within the Earth, in Earth's mantle, where you've got mantle materials slowly moving around in response to that surface mass redistribution, the glacier melting into the ocean. One of the things that we're able to do with geodesy is attach really precise GPS instruments to the bedrock in Antarctica, and this is the work some of my team have done. And we can measure the motion of the bedrock, especially the vertical motion. You know, is the bedrock going up or is it going down? What rate is it going up? This is normally in sort of millimetres a year or sub-millimetres a year in some cases. And we can, to take one example, there was a dramatic breakup of a floating glacier in the Antarctic Peninsula called the Larsen B Ice Shelf. It broke up in days, thousands of icebergs scattered in the ocean. That didn't affect sea level directly because it was already floating, but it was retaining, like a retaining wall. It was holding back the glaciers that were flowing into it from upstream into the mountains. And they all of a sudden started to move faster by a factor of 4 to 6. That transfer of all that weight of ice into the ocean unloaded the Earth in a sort of a natural experiment. And so we were able to track how, you know, the bedrock was going up by maybe a millimetre a year before that, and all of a sudden it was going up at 6 millimetres a year. And we were able to use that to constrain our understanding of what the mantle is like 200 kilometres below the surface of the Earth and how quickly it responds. And we can use that and have used that information to inform on how the solid Earth might actually act as a brake on future glacier retreat. Because as the ice melts, the Earth rebounds, it lifts the glaciers a little bit out of the water, and it turns out that that's enough just to slow down the glaciers a bit. You know, maybe wholesale retreat will take several decades longer. And so, you know, good news stories out of Antarctic science in the last little while is that maybe the solid Earth will put a little bit of a break on the retreat. That means we've got to keep on going with the climate mitigation. But, you know, that there is a little bit of a good news story there. So geodesy has been at the heart of that discovery.
From Hobart, Tasmania, we've been speaking with Australian scientist Professor Matt King. He's the director of the Australian Centre for Excellence in Antarctic Science. You can find more on the new paper about Antarctic tipping points and the Young Scientist Warning in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Matt King, thank you for spending time with us.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Adding just a few tips from the early career Antarctic researchers, the East Antarctic ice sheet alone holds enough water to raise global sea levels by approximately 50 meters, that's over 150 feet, if completely melted. The services of the Southern Ocean and Antarctica as a great ocean sink and planetary air conditioner have been taken for granted. Recent research has shown record low sea ice, extreme heat waves exceeding 40 degrees C above average temperatures, and increased instability around key ice shelves. Runaway ice loss and rapid and catastrophic sea level rise is possible within our lifetimes. Whether such irreversible tipping points have already passed is unknown. Just like the rest of the world, extreme events are happening in Antarctica. They are just not in the news. New ecosystems will appear there as ice disappears from both the sea and on land. A new part of the planet is being revealed to life, or perhaps returned to life after many millions of years. Antarctica has been frozen for at least 14 million years, and maybe as long as 38 million years. About 100 million years ago, the continent was part of the supercontinent, Gondwana, in a different location on the planet. It was covered in forests, ferns, conifers, and flowering plants. But a modern life ecosystem will appear now on new ground and open seas as the Antarctic ice retreats. By the way, we talked about geopolitical in the interview. Russia claims the world's largest oil and gas reserves are in the UK's zone of interest in the Antarctic. At 511 billion barrels, it is far more than Venezuela's 300 billion in reserves. If this oil and gas is drilled and burned, the climate for mammals is over. One expert concludes Russia will not attempt to break the Antarctic norms and treaties in its current weakened state, and due to the very high cost of technology to survive Antarctic conditions. We shall see. It is a wild west down there. Some countries claim territories, others ignore the claims and build bases wherever they want. The last safe space for peace and science is always at risk. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock for more news on Antarctic tipping points that could change the world.
Radio EcoShock.
Can climate change alter our brains? Yes, in many ways, says Clayton Aldrin. Clayton is a neuroscientist turned environmental journalist. He holds a master's in neuroscience and a master's in public policy from the University of Oxford. Clayton's work appears in major publications, and he is a senior data reporter at GRIST. After 7 years of digging, Aldrin just released his results in a new book, The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. Let's explore. Clayton Aldrin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, Alex. Thanks so much for having me.
You went through a complete life change about a decade ago, going from neuroscientist to environmental sleuth, journalist, and now author. Why?
It's always funny to kind of think about what the circuitous path here has been. I found myself having graduated from this master's degree in neuroscience, working as a professional neuroscientist, thinking about finishing a PhD, which I have to say, ultimately, I chose not to. And the reason I did not pursue academia is because I found myself coming into contact with more and more evidence suggesting that there was a really important social component, a really important human component to climate change, right? We saw in 2015, the Department of Defense release this really interesting report that suggested that climate threats to them, right, to the Pentagon, weren't about sea level rise, they weren't about rising temperatures per se, or threats to infrastructure, but rather the social effects, right, what these climatic changes might make people do to one another, that there were pressures that environmental variables could exert upon us behaviorally. And so you had the Pentagon saying things like this. There was a report around that same time period that came out from Stanford that suggested there was this really palpable relationship between climate change and conflict, right? The degree to which people were violent with one another could be predicted by various climatic variables. And so again, to me, as somebody who had been working as a neuroscientist, I found myself intrigued by the possibility that there might be something there, right? So frequently when we think about the climate, it's always in this other place. And, you know, it's never a story of intimacy. It's never something that is within us. And so, of course, as somebody who had been working in the brain sciences and saw these reports coming from these reputable sources that suggested they'd corrected for all the sociodemographic and income and, you know, various non-environmental variables under the sun, still to see an effect of climatic variables on behavior, you know, it kind of had some alarm bells ringing for me. And I have to say, I didn't feel that my job as a neuroscientist at the time, which basically consisted of modeling brain circuits while looking at a computer screen all day, really felt connected to this problem that really felt meaningful to me. And so this is, you know, a long way of saying that ultimately I left the lab with an intention to try to think about the brain in slightly more human terms. Think about it as this intimate organ that may indeed be subject to some environmental influence in a way that perhaps we haven't fully grasped, or indeed at the time had yet to fully grasp. And, you know, the story of the past decade or so has indeed been one of leaving neuroscience per se, but sticking with those questions of environmental influence on the brain, thinking about the degree to which we may be able to understand the human brain in slightly different terms if we pay attention to the manner that it relates to the environment that has wrapped itself around us.
We will be right back with more revelations from Clayton Aldrin on climate and our brains.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Now back to neuroscientist and environmental journalist Clayton Aldrin. We are talking about his new book, The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. Well, we're going to develop that a lot further, but just to start, do we know how our brains react when it is too hot, for example? Are there traceable changes? Do neurons or chemicals move around? How do these get translated in the brain?
The brain is exceptionally sensitive to temperature, right? Your body needs to work really hard to cool your brain when it's hot out because of this temperature sensitivity, right? And that cooling exercise takes energy. So anytime it's hot out, you have to go into a kind of overdrive to cool your brain in a manner that affords the kind of homeostatic behavior that we all hope for, right? That we all need to live sustainably in this world as organisms. And the thumbprint of that energy exertion, the thumbprints of the compensation for heat, are to be found everywhere in behavior. Okay, maybe everywhere is a little hyperbolic, but listen, we know that at higher temperatures, people are more aggressive. We know that they're more impulsive. They're not as good at performing academic tests. They tend to be less good at decision making, for example, or critical thinking. And there's a through line that runs through many of these ideas that has to do effectively with the infrastructure at the front of your brain, right, that prefrontal cortex, which tends to be responsible for the kinds of rational decision-making processes that counter impulsive behavior. And that thread would suggest that there's a specific action of heat and the compensatory homeostatic processes on that region that act in a manner that basically suggests that you have impulsive behavior taking the reins, right? When you have an overworked dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, that's the region that is kind of most newly evolutionarily developed in the brain. It's also the region that's kind of the primary rational decider, if we really had to point at one. If you've got an overworked dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and it is no longer able to balance out these emotional inputs coming from places like the amygdala, right, and the limbic system that are projecting into the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, this other chunk of that front of the brain that is coding for things like emotional insight into decision making. If that DLPFC can't balance the inputs from your emotional centers, well, then of course we're going to see an imprint of impulsivity on behavior when the heat rises. And that is exactly what we see. There are, in fact, cellular level changes. There are network effects, right? We see kind of a disconnection between brain regions that are usually more active together in the heat, right? Functional connectivity begins to look a little more randomized. There are kind of regional effects within the brain. So at all scales that we look, there appears to be this effect of heat on cognition.
And as we find in your book, this isn't just talking about humans. You found changes in ants, in fish, in all sorts of species as the heat goes up. So they're all going to change along with the climate too.
That's right. This is a product of nervous systems writ large, not just human nervous systems. And it's also not just a function of heat, right? We know that ocean acidification bears on sensory systems and marine animals, We know that there are various chemical changes that affect the ecology of shore creatures, right? We know that air pollution, for example, whether from wildfire smoke or particulate matter that is released by fossil fuel burning, right? These types of environmental pollutants can cause neuroinflammation. And with neuroinflammation comes, unfortunately, a higher likelihood of experiencing some kind of neurodegeneration. And there's a whole swath of behavioral effects of neurodegeneration. It's not just human brains per se. It's anything that has a nervous system that is responsive to its environment, which is to say, any organism with a nervous system.
Well, getting back to the human level, a huge study of workplace complaints by the U.S. postal workers showed grievances increased not just when it was hot outside, but even inside air-conditioned facilities. How can the aggression follow people inside?
Well, people love to imagine that we are infinitely adaptive and can snap our fingers and change our thoughts and feelings, and it's simply not the case, right? So the postal workers study is a really nice example of this effect, as is a study that's been conducted in the past 5 years or so on immigration judges all across the United States, right? These are also people who are working indoors, right? Probably in air-conditioned facilities. But when it's hot out, and this could be a function of it being very warm the night before, it could be a function of experiencing extreme heat on your way to the office, right, on your way to the workplace. If you reach this level of interruption, if your body is interrupted in this manner by heat and those compensatory processes kick in, all of a sudden you've started off a series of chemical cascades that take a while to reverse or to calm down. If you were to run to a bus, and certainly I've done that plenty of times, and you arrive at the bus and sit down in the seat, you're still going to be sweating for a while you're sitting in that seat. You might still feel overheated, even if that bus is cooler than the outdoor environment that you were experiencing at the time you were running. So the fact that these behavioral effects follow people indoors is unsurprising, simply because our adaptive resources don't operate as quickly as we like to imagine they do. It takes a long time for bodies, relative to the time scales that decision-making takes place, it takes a long time for bodies to acclimate, right, to adapt to new environments and to reach that homeostatic set point again.
And obviously, climate breakdown is much more than heat. And one of the things I like about this book is it's not just stuffed with graphs and facts. You have a lot of stories that take us right into the people who feel these things. Talk to us about people who were burned or flooded out of their homes.
Yeah, I mean, it's an unfortunate reality that inevitably when we're talking about nervous systems and these abstract terms, at the end of the day, we're talking about people. We're talking about, in the case of humans, people. In the case of other organisms, real individual animals, for example. And the individual story, I think, is where the rubber really hits the road here. You know, I reported on, for example, a study that took place in New York around the time Hurricane Sandy hit. And, you know, the kind of grand research arc there was you had this cognitive neuroscientist named Yoko Nomura who had effectively, for the purpose of understanding the relationship between stress and pregnancy, collected a series of participants for a study that sought to measure stress variables in expecting mothers and try to get an understanding of the effects of those stressors on the children for the first 10 years of life or so. And so she's setting up this study. She's recruited maybe 400 participants to it. And lo and behold, Sandy rolls into town. And so all of a sudden, there's this natural experiment there about a decade ago, wherein some of the mothers that had been recruited into Dr. Nomura's study were indeed going to be carrying a child at the time the storm hit, whereas some of them had already given birth or indeed conceived after the storm. And so there's this natural cohort approach wherein you can look at, again, 10 years later, 6 years later, whatever the follow-up period may be, any potential presumptive effects of the storm itself, on the, you know, young behavioral experiences, the developmental behavioral experiences of these young children. And lo and behold, for folks who are exposed to the storm in utero, for these young kids, you know, as early as preschool, you saw an increased risk of ADHD, conduct disorder, anxiety, depression, right? And we're talking about symptomology present in preschoolers. And it's not just, oh, a kid was 5% more likely, 10% more likely to experience one of these behavioral disorders. We're talking about 20 or 30x effect sizes. And so it's really unignorable. When we talk about the human cost here, in the case of something like Dr. Nomura's study, yes, we're thinking really rigorously about the expecting mothers who lived through a superstorm while carrying a child. And also, we have to think about the children themselves who are born into this world having had no direct physical experience with the storm except that which they experienced in the womb, who now have the thumbprint of that storm behaviorally influencing the rest of their experience for who knows how long, right? And furthermore, may it be transferred to the next generation, because these effects are often manifest in epigenetic manners, and epigenetic effects are heritable. And so it's not just about the person experiencing the storm. It's about the next generation and the generation after that.
Wow. And you also talk about Parkinson's and ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease in your book. Is there a connection to climate change there?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the answer is yes. This book is, it's not a horror story, but there are some scary components of it. And I think that the neurodegeneration account is one of the scariest, mainly because we don't know where any of this is going, per se. What we do know is that extreme heat, exposure to particulate matter, right, air pollution, we know that these environmental variables have a relationship with neurodegeneration. We know that there's a relationship between, for example, air pollution and dementia, right, or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. But people are exposed to a whole toxic soup, you know, for much of their lives. What we don't know is the manner in which this soup interacts with itself and interacts within the human body. We don't know the synergistic relationship between something like air pollution and extreme heat on the likelihood of experiencing something like Alzheimer's. And this is all complicated by the fact that there are a whole suite of neurotoxins out there to which people are becoming more and more likely to be exposed that have similar profiles when it comes to risk factors that we probably want to be avoiding. And we don't know how any of those risk factors interact with, again, the other environmental variables like heat and air pollution. You named cyanobacteria, right? Blue-green algae as one example here. And it's a scary one, right? This is an organism that thrives in warm waters, thrives as a function of runoff from agricultural operations, right? These synthetic fertilizers get into rivers, and the rivers wind up dumping the stuff into bays and lakes, and lo and behold, the fertilizer fertilizes whatever it touches, and so you see these big blooms, right? These blooms of blue-green algae in our freshwater systems and in brackish water that are becoming larger in size and in, you know, exhibiting themselves in greater frequency as the climate warms. Now, we've known about cyanobacteria for a long time. It's been around for billions of years, literally, and we know that you're probably not supposed to drink this stuff, for example. We know that there are toxicities that are well described in terms of the types of water sources that may be or maybe not contaminated by blue-green algae. What's new is that we also appear to now understand that cyanobacterial blooms release an airborne neurotoxin that is one of the greatest causal predictors of something like ALS, right, Lou Gehrig's disease. You can look at a whole bunch of neurotoxins, a whole bunch of suspected chemicals, for example, that may explain the incidence of ALS in a given area. And if you want to try to understand which one of those variables has the greatest causal relationship with the outcome of interest, in this case, neurodegeneration. You can run a whole bunch of fancy statistics, and plenty of scientists have done this, and lo and behold, this neurotoxin that's released by blue-green algae is the top predictor, right? It is the predictor that explains the greatest amount of variance in terms of these rates of ALS that we see crop up in a spatial manner. That's a little bit scary, right? The fact that there's this debilitating neurodegenerative condition, often well explained by exposure to a neurotoxin, that is becoming more and more frequent in terms of our exposure profiles because of a changing climate, right? Because waters are warming and because we're seeing more extreme storms that are loosening more of the synthetic fertilizer into streams and rivers and therefore other freshwater systems. So there's a lot to be said there. And the story isn't a particularly pretty one, but it's one that I think we need to be paying attention to because we know enough to be concerned, but we don't know enough to really know what we've gotten ourselves into here.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org, free for all, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with neuroscientist and environmental journalist Clayton Aldern. His new book is called The Weight of Nature. Many of us scan feeds of news showing climate-related events or disasters. Cars float down suddenly, flooded streets in Europe, or a hurricane or wildfire wipes out a town. And these extreme events get a lot of hits and views. Probably a billion people see it. Do you think this diet of bad news also physically changes our brains?
Well, probably. But it also depends on, A, the type of person you are, B, the type of news that you're consuming, and C, your relationships with the environment writ large already. For example, when we think about this idea of climate anxiety, it's kind of pervasive worry that some people experience, these senses of doom with respect to the future that are becoming more and more common. We think about climate anxiety. One of the things that's kind of paradoxical about it is that some people who express a lot of anxiety about our climatic future channel that anxiety into action, right? Actually, this experience of worry is a galvanizing experience. And you see among some people who have extremely high levels of this expression of climate anxiety, a ton of pro-environmental behaviors. And the relationship is such that you can even consider, because it's so strong, you can consider greater climate anxiety to be predictive of pro-environmental behavior. So that's actually a good thing, right? That something like reading the news, thinking about our future, becoming worried, may actually spur some kind of action. Now, there are other people who, as a function of climate anxiety, become ruminative, right, or become isolating in their behaviors, right? They feel demotivated. And so in those cases, where there's this exposure to awful news 24/7, more information about the topic tends not to spur action. And we actually don't really know at a psychological level what the difference between those types of people are. Some folks have some theories as to why environmental news, for example, is galvanizing to some, but demotivating to others, even when both of those populations may be expressing high levels of climate anxiety. But I don't think we have a truly satisfying answer on the table yet. What we do know is that there's probably some truth to what you suggested, that awareness of the issue can indeed spur anxiety about the issue. But I would argue that's probably expected, and what's the alternative, right? We can't turn a blind eye. I think that awareness is the first step here, and it is incumbent on us as a society to figure out how that awareness can best be translated into action, right? Can best be translated into climate solutions.
Clayton, deeper in your book, there are some puzzles. For example, you say we don't just think about climate change. It's not like an outside operating system. Our very identities depend on us thinking that we comprehend climate. Do you want to get into that?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I mean, again, this is a statement about organisms with nervous systems whatsoever. This is a statement about anything that must navigate the world. And what it suggests is that navigating the world depends on modeling one's environment. Right? You use the sensory organs to which you have access, eyes, ears, nose, etc., to take in signals of this world. And in your mind, right, your mind is effectively the route by which you as an agent have access, right, have conscious access to the generative model that your brain is building of the world, right? So when these sensory signals come in, your mind looks at what they are describing, and it compares what they're describing to the expectations that your model holds about the world, right? Because you've lived as long as you've been alive, so your brain, your mind have been working to model that world such that as you move about, you're not constantly surprised by that world, right? The only way that we can navigate the world is by honing our expectations. And so if we understand the brain as effectively performing this generative modeling task, we can also use that framework to understand our relationship with place, with climate, with culture, and it's a little bit of a tall order, but I mean, the basic trajectory of the argument would say, well, hey, listen, if brains are basically these devices that afford a certain precision of estimate about the world, right? That afford a certain expectation, with a precision component that allows us to navigate the world appropriately. We don't want to be surprised by that world. Then really what we're talking about is this idea that what we ought to be doing culturally, between one another, societally, is instituting a kind of culture, right, and identifying psychological elements and behaviors around us and between us that aid us in performing that modeling task. What does that look like in practice? The climate is one example of a set of expectations, right? The climate doesn't really exist per se physically in the world. Right. Weather exists. Weather is real. When it rains and water falls on my hand, that's ephemeral, but it is a physical process. The climate is this arbitrary set of expectations. They can be expressed in the language of science, and they often are. For example, we describe the climate as a function of some 30-year average of a handful of meteorological variables in a given point in space, and we recognize normal as a presentation, right, an experience of those meteorological variables that falls within this kind of arbitrary boundary that we've set up around them. We choose to express climate in the language of science, but we don't have to, right? The point is that the climate is a set of expectations that culturally we hold about the world in order for people and other organisms to navigate that world stably, right, to navigate it sustainably, to navigate it in a manner such that they aren't surprised. Now, the problem, of course, is that the climate is changing, right? And so is it any surprise that as this set of expectations change, that some other elements of our modeling exercises, right, some other elements of our brains are changing in kind, right? You brought up the notion of identity. Identity, while we tend to think of it as this individuating process, as this individualized process, while it's true that the development of identity is something that plays out within your own modeling exercise of yourself, it has a lot more to do with the rest of the world than it does with you per se. Because what happens when we define the self? Well, sure, you look in the mirror, you recognize that you're a thing that is somehow separate from your environment, and you know, there's a boundary between your skin and everything else. And then you develop interests and you say, oh yeah, I like the color orange. I have a favorite number. That's what it means to be me. These are my parents. All of a sudden though, we're outside of the self, right? Because you start affiliating your identity with other people. You say, these are my friends, right? You say, oh, I have a favorite sports team. And furthermore, right, and this is the last step of identity development, you affiliate yourself with groups and practices and places, right? You say, well, this is where I'm from. I'm a Minnesotan, you know, and this is what that means for me. Again, you're building a model of identity that's predicated on an external world, and that world is changing. So is it any surprise that as these physical realities shift before us, that we're going to feel a sense of instability internally? I would say no, it's not a surprise. In fact, that's exactly what nervous systems were designed to do.
Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners, or maybe what you hope your new book, The Weight of Nature, will do?
I think the word awareness is an important one. We talked about how familiarity with, fluency with some of these ideas can be scary, right? And there's no question that these are potentially horrifying ideas. And at the same time, awareness is what is going to move us in the direction of solving the problem. And I mean that at both an individual and a societal level, right? Societally, we can't be ignoring the behavioral, the neurocognitive, the neurodevelopmental effects of climate change. Right now, climate economic modeling, to the extent that it integrates health information, has nothing to say about any of the stuff that we've talked about today. So when a policymaker says, well, we should build a solar farm because there's a human benefit to doing so, their job is actually made more difficult by not including the neurological costs of climate change into their modeling efforts, because they're basically ignoring some of the health benefits that could be averted by deploying a climate solution. So awareness societally is important because it affords this ability to more readily capture the costs of climate change. And if we're paying attention to the costs, we can do a better job of justifying solutions. Individually, I think awareness looks a lot like mindfulness. It looks a lot like shoring up a kind of biological resilience by maintaining this kind of active presence, right? This mindful presence that so frequently, neurologically speaking, offers a kind of antidote to many of the effects we've described. You know, by way of example, if you're aware of the relationship between heat and aggression, for example, you're going to be more likely the next time it's hot out to notice in yourself the thumbprints, right, the fingerprints of that heat on your behavior. You're going to be more likely, if you're checking in with yourself, if you're maintaining this notion of mindful awareness, right, interoception, mindful awareness of the body, you're going to be more likely to notice the degree to which the environment is influencing your behavior in a way that you would otherwise perhaps prefer to be behaving. With these approaches to thinking through both the body and the outside world in conjunction with one another, we all of a sudden find ourselves at a point where we're actually able to recapture some of the agency that some of these climatic forces are stripping from us. If you're able to intervene and say, oh yeah, well, it's hot out, of course that's why I'm feeling more aggressive, you're probably going to be less likely to commit an aggressive act in the first place. And so I think that there's something to be said for a kind of mindful presence that bears these effects in mind, such that when we encounter them in the world, and this isn't going to work for cyanobacteria per se, it's not going to work for brain-eating amoebae, but when we encounter air pollution, when we encounter extreme heat, we may be able to intervene accordingly.
We've been speaking with neuroscientist and environmental journalist Clayton Aldern. Look for his new book, The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Brains. Find links and more info to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And you can find Clayton at www.claytonaldern.com. Clayton, thank you for sharing this, even though it is a little scary at times.
Hey, thanks so much for having me and hanging in there with the fear.
Next week, for the alleged holiday season, I hope to rummage through years of climate songs for the best green music, plus a collection of new AI-enhanced music developed for Radio EcoShock shows. Then we return with more blistering science and issues in the new year of 2025. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.